It's Thursday, July 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Democrats nominate Hillary Clinton for U.S. president. Another deadly blast in Syria.
He can't direct a coup from 7,000 miles away. I mean, from Pennsylvania to the Middle East is quite an effort.
An exiled Muslim cleric denies an alleged role in the failed Turkey coup. Also ahead, the United States encourages mediation in the South China Sea. And what will you see on your next road trip? It's all on today's International Edition. The U.S. Democratic Party made history Tuesday by nominating Hillary Clinton for president, the first woman to be a major political party's White House standard bearer. Later, her husband, former President Bill Clinton, portrayed his wife as a dynamic force for change.
Hillary will make us stronger together. You know it because she spent a lifetime doing it. I hope you'll do it. I hope you'll elect her. The reason you should elect her is that in the greatest country on earth, we have always been about tomorrow. Your children and grandchildren will bless you forever if you do.
Hillary Clinton will face the Republican Party nominee, Donald Trump, who is currently on the campaign trail in Florida, where he downplayed his alleged connections to Russia while encouraging that nation Wednesday to hack into Hillary Clinton's email server to find the, quote, 30,000 emails that are missing from her time as Secretary of State. All this after U.S. computer experts have said in recent days they believe that Russian state actors are behind the hacking into computers at the Democratic National Committee headquarters in Washington.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
Another strange twist in this presidential election cycle. VOA's Doug Bernard joins us live from the Democrat National Convention in Philadelphia. Quite a backdrop for tonight's activities, Doug.
Well, hello from Philadelphia. And, you know, Jim, it's a darn shame that we don't really have any news to talk about here tonight.
Correct. So what's the buzz in the convention hall? Mention of Mr. Trump's comments?
Oh, a lot of mention. In fact, there's so much talk here in this overly large bubble of those who are in the convention that we're beginning to hear that some Democratic officials, party officials, are starting to get a little concerned that all of this talk about what Mr. Trump may have said, what he did say, what he may have meant by it, and of course the deeper questions of who got those DNC emails in the first place. The worry is now that all of that is beginning to overshadow, you know, some of the speeches. President Clinton had a major speaking role last night. People are talking about it, yes, but, you know, I think a lot of news organizations are actually leading with the Trump-Russia story. So there's lots of people talking about it, but unfortunately at this point there's just not much to say. It's just such a confusing story.
Absolutely. And of course, the Democrats wanted to portray quite a different image in their convention as opposed to the one that the Republicans held last week in Cleveland, Ohio. And we're expecting the vice presidential candidate to be appearing today.
That's right. So this evening, another blockbuster lineup. I mean, Dr. Jill Biden, Vice President Joe Biden, probably one of, you know, the last time that we're going to see him on a major national political stage. And then, of course, the president and Senator Tim Kaine, who is the vice presidential nominee. Interestingly, you know, Mr. Kaine has been perhaps criticized for having kind of a low-energy approach. I'm not sure that that's entirely true. I think when we saw Senator Kaine and Secretary Clinton last Saturday, I believe it was, he seemed to have plenty of energy. And more interestingly, Secretary Clinton was on stage. She really seemed to humanize her. So, you know, that's the best thing I think that a vice presidential nominee can do is to make the candidate better. So we're going to be hearing a lot tonight. I do expect that we're going to hear a little bit more about terrorism, national security issues. 2 days now, we really haven't talked about that. And very briefly, the White House is beginning to release some excerpts, as they traditionally do a few hours now before this speech. We expect that President Obama tonight, among other things, will say that, quote, there has never been another man or woman more qualified to be president of the United States. That's quite a statement, but again, whereas President Clinton's speech last night, that was really like a first spouse's speech, you know, almost like a love note from one spouse to another. President Obama, I think, is going to come out tonight and really kind of try to, pardon the phrase, but drop the mic in making the case for Secretary Clinton.
Well, it was a rather interesting speech last night from Bill Clinton, and a little bit of insight into Bill and Hillary, the couple.
Very much so. You know, it's interesting. I've heard some criticism here. Perhaps President Clinton didn't seem to have as much energy as he used to. Well, you know, we all age. Maybe it wasn't his very best offering, but even on a bad day, President Clinton's oratory is just about better than anybody on a good day. It was interesting, though, that some people were saying he didn't address the elephant in the room, and by that we mean the marital struggles that the two of them have gone through that everybody knows about. I'm not so sure that that's exactly the case, because I distinctly remember one line where he was making the case, and he said, Hillary Clinton will not give up on you, and that's what most networks used. And then he paused, and he said, she didn't give up on me, and the implication seemed clear to at least me as I was listening to the speech.
Well, quite an amazing orator, as are you. VOA's Doug Bernard, live at the Democrat National Convention. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you so much.
Well, time now for a social media segment. As always, our G. Abby Lee joins me right here in the studio with a wrap of all the online chatter. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. The latest trending story online is Virginia Senator Tim Kaine receiving the vice presidential nomination Wednesday. And many people are also tweeting about President Barack Obama and Vice President Joe Biden's speech scheduled for later in the day.
Well, I gotta ask, what are some of the trending hashtags?
In addition to the usual DNC, Dems in Philly, and DNC in PHL, another popular hashtag is hashtag DNC walkout. That's referring to some of Sanders' supporters walking out of the arena after he motioned for Clinton to become the Democratic nominee Tuesday night.
Well, in the last couple of hours, people have begun to share the breaking news story about the Clinton Foundation. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. The IRS, or the Internal Revenue Service, confirmed that it's launching review of the foundation. Now, the review is on the nonprofit's tax-exempt status. House Republicans have accused the charity of corruption for a long time. The Daily Caller and The Hill were quick to post this story online Wednesday afternoon. And one of the most liked replies to The Hill's Facebook post is critical of Hillary Clinton. A user named Colin commented, and this would be a Clinton presidency. Constant scandals from one of the most corrupt and unliked nominees in the history of this country. Harsh. A less popular comment is from a user named David. He wrote, great. More taxpayer dollars wasted on bogus attacks on Hillary by GOP haters.
Well, speaking of the GOP, I'm sure there was reaction from the Republican nominee.
Definitely. Donald Trump sent out several tweets on his thoughts about the about his Democratic rival since her nomination Tuesday night, and one of them reads like this. Crooked Hillary Clinton wants to flood our country with Syrian immigrants that we know little or nothing about. The danger is massive. No. He also came up with a new hashtag. Hashtag MAGA, or M-A-G-A. That's an acronym for Make America Great Again. Jim, back to you.
Well, thank you. That's a great again wrap-up from G. And you can tweet your comments and questions to our Twitter stream at VOA underscore IE. Find myself and G as well on Twitter at VOA Stevenson and at G Abby Lee. Among the top stories trending in Asia, Afghanistan alleges former leader of LET behind ISIS attacks. Prostitution allegations investigated against Samsung boss. Taiwanese fishing boats land on disputed Taiping Island. Indonesia's president reshuffles cabinet. And Korea no closer to peace on armistice anniversary. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website. And also, if you have a smartphone, on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. More than 40 people are dead and nearly 150 others wounded in the northeastern Syrian city of Kamshili near the Turkish border Wednesday following two large explosions near a Kurdish militia compound. Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the deadly blasts. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
A crowd of young men dug frantically through the rubble of a building demolished by the blast to pull a man who was still alive from what remained of his home. An old woman whose home was destroyed cursed the perpetrators. A reporter for VOA's Kurdish service, Zeyna Omar, was among those injured in the blasts. Members of his family were also wounded. VOA's Kurdish service says Omar's home, which was near the bombings, has been destroyed. Rami Abdulrahman of the Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights told Arab media that a suicide truck bomb demolished the facade of the headquarters of the Kurdish militia, which controls the western part of Kamishli. The Syrian government controls another chunk of the city, including an outlying airbase. Islamic State, through its Amaq news agency, said it carried out the attack and that it was targeting Kurdish security forces. IS has been battling the U.S.-supported Kurdish YPG militia over control of large swathes of territory in the north of Syria, including the town of Munbij, north of Aleppo. It has carried out numerous suicide attacks in the area and across both Syria and Iraq in recent months. A suicide blast killed six members of the Kurdish Internal Security Force, known as the Asayish, in April. In July, an IS suicide bomber killed at least 16 people in Hasaka. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Turkey's post-coup attempt crackdown continues with reports that nearly 50 more journalists are being sought as authorities investigate those with alleged ties to exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen, who is suspected of having orchestrated the failed July 15th coup. Writing in the New York Times, Gulen, who lives in Pennsylvania, condemned the coup attempt and denied having any part in it. He said Mr. Erdogan is blackmailing the United States by threatening to curb his country's support for the International Coalition Against Islamic State unless Gulen is extradited. Regional analyst Jonathan Edelman, a professor of international studies at the University of Denver, tells VOA's Victor Beatty that he usually greets such statements with skepticism, but says that he believes Gulen does have a point.
This coup was very odd. Turkey's already had four or five coups before, and this coup was not like any coup that ever had been launched in Turkey. What is the first thing you would want to do if you were trying to stage a successful coup? You would go after the leader, and you would devote serious, you know, attention, a lot of manpower. You would go at the leader. Tayyip Erdogan was down on the coast, and yet a very small group of his defenders managed to stop this effort. The Turkish coups have always been from the top down, which is not atypical elsewhere. This was a coup that was kind of from the officers in the middle and even to the bottom. Thirdly, how could anybody possibly have come, as Tayyip Erdogan did, within days, a list of 50,000 people who participated in the coup? That's impossible. So although normally I would be dubious of what Gulen is saying, the fact is that I think that it's unfortunately logical, because what he's saying is what we are afraid of, that Turkey, which had been really a model for the Middle East in terms of strong economic growth, doubling their output in a period of 10 years, democracy, and trying to end military coups, now seems intent on taking Turkey almost like in the Vladimir Putin way as a kind of one-man dictatorship. And that is something that we're really very concerned about.
Mr. Erdogan, Mr. Gulen writes, is blackmailing the U.S. by threatening to curb his country's support for International Coalition Against Islamic State unless they extradite him, and he says the U.S. must resist it. Is there enough evidence to go through with the extradition?
I don't think so, although at the end of the day it will be more political than anything else. But you'd need hard, concrete evidence. And it's going to be hard to come up with, because the question you always ask in a situation like this is, who benefits? And the tremendous beneficiary is Tayyip Erdogan, who's done all the things, unfortunately, that Gulen has complained about. And he can't direct a coup from 7,000 miles away. I mean, from Pennsylvania to the Middle East is quite an effort. I'm not saying he didn't want to overthrow him, but I'm saying that many of the people who are coming out now are not tied directly into Erdogan are also saying we're very dubious about this claim, especially how fast it was all over. You know, if you've got the military on your side and you're launching a coup, you go all out. You seize the important targets right away, and this didn't happen in this coup.
And you'll find more on the story at voanews.com. The United States says it is encouraged by the willingness of China and the Philippines to engage in direct dialogue over the South China Sea following a tribunal ruling against Beijing earlier this month. In Manila Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with senior Philippine officials, including the new Philippines president, Rodrigo Duterte. Kerry said at a news conference, the United States encourages all parties with South China Sea claims, including the Chinese and the Philippines, to negotiate to work through issues diplomatically and increase confidence-building measures.
The decision itself is a binding decision, but we're not trying to create a confrontation. We're trying to create a solution, mindful of the rights of people that are established under the law. So whatever, as we encourage the Philippines and we encourage the Chinese and we encourage other claimants to engage in negotiations, that's not new.
China has long said it will only settle maritime territorial disputes through bilateral negotiations, rejecting calls for any multilateral solution. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, the price of gas is down considerably from last year, and the American Automobile Association says 56% of Americans plan to take at least one road trip during this traditional summer vacation time of year. Well, before travelers reach their destination, many unusual sights can lure them off the highways. Erica Celeste takes a look at the time-honored tradition of roadside attractions.
If it's found on an American roadside, free, extremely oversized, or just plain strange, chances are it's probably a roadside attraction. No one knows exactly how many there are because there is no mandatory registry, and categorizing is a bit subjective. But June Julian with Steuben County, Indiana Visitors Bureau says the website Roadside America lists about 15,000 attractions.
Well, some of the reasons to go to roadside attractions would be you've been in the car for hours, the children are antsy, the pets need some attention, and you can get out, you can stretch your legs, you can have a little bonding time with your family on something, and you're looking at something that's different. You don't see it every day.
There are hundreds of roadside attractions in every state. Some are as subtle as a spot in the middle of a lonely dirt road where three states meet. Once you brush the gravel from a small plaque, you can stand in Michigan, Indiana, and Ohio at the same time. Others, such as the Smiley Face Water Tower, can be seen for miles. It's part of a fraternity of more than 30 Smiley Face Water Towers across the country.
We stopped several times to stretch our legs and rest your mind a little bit from the road.
In addition to taking in a few well-known roadside attractions, Zach Dunaway, on a 12-hour trip from Atlanta, Georgia to Michigan, started his own attractions by snapping selfies at every state line rest stop. Mike Schwartz from Toledo, Ohio, says stopping at roadside attractions is a great way to teach kids and bond with his family.
Kids get to see a lot of different parts of the United States and put the screens down and you get to talk to your mom and dad. And older kids probably don't like that as much, but the younger kids, it's important for them to learn.
Roadside attractions gained popularity after World War II when soldiers returned home. The men had seen the world and were eager for more adventure and to explore their own country.
As the highway system began to be developed, people started to travel. And this was before the advent of fast food restaurants, and there just weren't a lot of places to pull off. And areas started to say, hey, we want these people off the roads, we want them in our areas spending money. And they started to maybe build things that would attract people.
Restaurants and shops tried all sorts of gimmicks to lure travelers, everything from bright murals to crazy statues. The world's largest was always a big draw, the largest ball of twine, rocking chair, or tire. And if large was good for manufactured items, it was even better for natural things. Kokomo, Indiana is home to the world's largest bull. Old Ben died in 1910 and is now stuffed and under glass. He came in at a whopping 2,140 kilograms and stood nearly 2 meters tall. There are also the plain strange sights like shoe trees along the road festooned with sneakers and other footwear. I'm Erica Celeste, road tripping the state of Indiana.
Thanks for joining us on International Edition. We hope you have a wonderful day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Crude oil is the mainstay of Libya's economy. It is therefore good news for all Libyans that the National Oil Corporation signed an agreement to reintegrate Eastern leadership under a unified, independent management structure. If implemented, the agreement could rejuvenate Libya's economy and benefit all Libyans. In Libya, oil is king, with 90% of government revenues generated by oil production. The National Oil Corporation and its subsidiaries traditionally controlled a vast majority of the country's oil output and infrastructure, including oil fields, pipelines, refineries, and production facilities. It is not surprising that once the alliance that ousted longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi and his regime splintered and began to fight amongst themselves over territory and resources, Libya's oil production plummeted. Oil infrastructure suffered frequent attacks by factional forces, as well as by Daesh and other violent extremists, hindering production and closing export terminals and ports. Over time, certain Libyan entities not recognized by the international community attempted to export oil illegally. Because Libya's resources belong to all of its people, not just those few who can get their hands on them, the United Nations Security Council passed a resolution condemning such illicit sales and called on member states to take all necessary steps to prevent vessels carrying illicit Libyan oil from entering their ports. On July 6th, the governments of France, Germany, Italy, Spain, the United Kingdom, and the United States issued a joint statement on Libya, welcoming and supporting the agreement to reunify the National Oil Corporation, stating, "We urge all Libyans to work together to restore Libya's oil production and exports, and stress the importance of Libyan resource wealth being used for the benefit of all Libyans." The six governments pledged to use all means necessary at the request of Libya's government of national accord to stop the illegal shipment of oil from Libya and to sanction those who would exploit or divert Libya's oil or wealth. Libya's national economic institutions, including the National Oil Corporation, must remain united under the sole stewardship of the government of national accord and must use Libya's resources for the benefit of all Libyans.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.